its nightly radio chorus across Europe. Trepper, a Polish Jew, had been planted in France before the war. There he cultivated an influential circle of German businessmen and military leaders, from whom he extracted masses of information. Hounded by German radio sleuths who tracked his transmitters with special directional equipment, Trepper still survived, but his time was growing short. Other spies were relatively invulnerable. In Switzerland, a Hungarian communist named Alexander Rado ran both a publishing business and a spy ring. One of his agents, Rudolf Rosler, was probably the most valuable weapon the Soviet Union possessed. The shy, bespectacled Rosler, codenamed Lucy, had contacts inside the high command of the German army. His sources, never identified to this day, provided him with almost every decision made by the Führer. Rosler had passed both strategic and tactical battle plans on to Moscow, usually within 24 hours of their having been approved. His communiques were worth many divisions to Stalin. Thus, Moscow knew explicit details about Operation Blue, the names of the divisions involved in the attack, the number of tanks to be committed to battle, plus the operation's ultimate goal of severing the Volga River lifeline and capturing the oil fields of the Caucasus. As the offensive progressed, Lucy also had forwarded each major shift in tactics, from Hitler's indecision about taking Voronezh to his startling insistence on splitting his armies on the steppe. Yet, Stalin was hesitant when Lucy told of Hitler's confusion at Voronezh. The premier had always believed that the Germans intended to take Moscow from the south, and therefore might be using the drive toward the Caucasus as a feint to draw Russian reserves from the capital. But when Lucy's torrent of inner strategy continued to accurately forecast the German army's course across southern Russia, Stalin began to base Russian defense plans on Lucy's confidences. While Hitler chased two hares at the same time, Stalin, on July 13th, had agreed to a plan set forth by his general staff, Stavka, to withdraw Soviet units as far as the Volga, thereby forcing the Germans to spend the coming winter in open country. Almost a week later, when Stavka received the astonishing news that the German army groups had begun to split their forces on the steppe, Russian strategy changed again. Until this time, little consideration had been given to making a determined stand on the west bank of the Volga. Now, Stalin made a decision of momentous significance. He sent an order to members of the city Soviet, city council, in Stalingrad to prepare for a siege. As of July 21st, they were to organize the entire population in a frantic effort to build a fortified ring around the outskirts of the city, while Stavka tried to beef up the small military garrison. No one realized it at the time, but this decision to stand fast would change the course of history. A few days later, on the night of August 1st, Stalin had made another attempt to strengthen Stalingrad. Near midnight, a Red Army staff car pulled up to the entrance of the Kremlin's private quarters, and a squat, gray-haired officer eased slowly out of the back seat to limp painfully into the building. At the door to the premier's office, 49-year-old General Andrei Ivanovich Yeremenko put down his cane, braced himself, and walked briskly into the room. Stalin greeted him warmly. Shaking Yeremenko's hand, he asked, "Do you consider yourself recovered?" Yeremenko said he felt fine. Another general interrupted, "It looks like his wound is still bothering him. He's limping." Yeremenko shrugged off the remark, so Stalin let the matter drop. "We shall consider that Comrade Yeremenko has fully recovered. We need him now very badly. Let's get down to business." Stalin spoke to the point. Due to the circumstances around Stalingrad, prompt action must be taken to fortify this most important sector of the front and to improve control of the troops. Stalin went on to offer Yeremenko command of one of the fronts in the south. The general accepted, and Stalin sent him to Stavka headquarters a few blocks away to be briefed about the situation on the steppe. Yeremenko spent the better part of August 2nd studying the maps of Stalingrad and the surrounding area. As he stared at the topographical details of the 40-mile strip of land between the Don and Volga rivers, he concluded that in order to attack Stalingrad, the Germans would have to concentrate most of their strength in that narrow bridge where the Don and Volga come closest to each other. And he wondered whether that type of deployment might offer the Russians a chance for a successful counterattack from the flanks. After selecting the nucleus of a staff, he went back to Stalin for another conference. This time, the premier seemed more nervous and preoccupied. Puffing absently on his pipe, Stalin listened while his army chief of staff, Marshal Alexander Mikhailovich Vasilevsky, briefed him on the day's activities. When the marshal concluded, Stalin turned to Yeremenko and asked, "Is everything clear to you, comrade?" Yeremenko spoke up against the idea of two Russian fronts in the same region, especially since their boundaries met in the exact center of Stalingrad. To him, trying to coordinate the defense of a city with another commander equal in responsibility would be utterly confusing, if not tragically impossible. Stalin left at that point to take some phone calls from the south. When he returned, he was subdued and obviously worried. Picking up Yeremenko's protests about dual fronts, he said firmly, "Leave everything as it was outlined." Stalin told Yeremenko to take over the southeastern front and hold back the German 4th Panzer Army coming toward the Volga from Katynakova. Unhappy with this assignment, the general asked if he could lead the Stalingrad front, comprising the northern part of the city and beyond to the Don, because he wanted to attack the German flank in that region. Stalin broke in brusquely. "Your proposition deserves attention, but in the future. Now the German offensive must be stopped." Stalin had sounded annoyed, and when he paused to fill his pipe with tobacco, Yeremenko mended his fences by agreeing with his commander-in-chief. As Stalin saw him to the door, he warned Yeremenko to take drastic measures to enforce discipline at the front. Now, on the night of August 5th, Joseph Stalin paced his office waiting for further news from the steppe. Yeremenko had phoned from Stalingrad. He had sounded optimistic, but Stalin knew that 60 miles to the southwest, German tanks were brushing aside scattered Russian resistance and charging toward the city. Unless Yeremenko stopped them, Stalingrad would fall in a few days. Chapter 4. The city that Hitler had never planned to capture and that Stalin had never intended to defend lay sweltering under the summer sun. No rain had fallen for 2 months, and day after day, the temperature soared well above 100 degrees. Worse, the humidity that typifies a river town was totally enervating. When the wind blew, it always came from the west, hot, dusty, bringing no relief. The citizens of Stalingrad were accustomed to being uncomfortable, and they joked about how the heat made the concrete sidewalks bulge and buckle upward, splitting the slabs into giant fragments. As for the shiny asphalt roads, all one could do was watch the mirages rising from the wide boulevards in the center of town. Few people in this cauldron knew their city was about to become a battlefield, but the tragedy of war had always menaced the region. In the year 1237, the Golden Horde of the Great Khan had crossed the Volga at this perfect fording point, ravaged the territory, galloped on to the Don, and then swept westward into European Russia, stopping their invasion just short of Vienna and the Polish border. During the 13th and 14th centuries, Moscow began her own expansion into Asia. The region became a border post from which Russian soldiers sallied forth to fight the Mongols. When the Tsar decreed the area safe for settlement in 1589, he established a trading center called Tsaritsyn. In Tatar language, the name was pronounced Sarisu and meant yellow water. Though the location was safe enough to settle, it never knew peace. Russian brigands wreaked havoc on the citizenry as they plundered their way north and south along the length of the Volga. The geographical key to bringing the wealth of the Caucasus to Moscow and Leningrad, the heartland of Russia, as well as being the east-west gate to Asia, Tsaritsyn was a place for which men would always do battle. The legendary Cossack leader, Stenka Razin, took the city in 1670 and held it during a bloody siege. Just over 100 years later, another Cossack named Emelyan Pugachev decided to challenge the power of Catherine the Great and stormed Tsaritsyn in an effort to free the serfs. The rebellion ended as could be expected. The Tsarina's executioner cut off Pugachev's head. Still, the city prospered, finally taking its place in the Industrial Revolution when, in 1875, a French company built the region's first steel mill. Within a few years, the city's population had grown to more than 100,000, and during World War I, nearly one quarter of the inhabitants were working in its factories. Despite the boom, the city reminded visitors of America's Wild West. Clusters of tents and ramshackle houses sprawled aimlessly along the riverbank. More than 400 saloons and brothels catered to a boisterous clientele. Oxen and camels shared the unpaved streets with sleek horse-drawn carriages. Cholera epidemics scourged the population regularly as the result of mountains of garbage and sewage that collected in convenient gullies. It was almost predictable, then, that the Bolshevik Revolution would bring Tsaritsyn to its knees. The fighting for control of the region was unusually bitter, and Joseph Stalin, leading only a tiny force, managed to hold off three generals of the White Army. Finally driven from the city, Stalin regrouped his forces in the safety of the steppe country, fell on the flanks of the White Army in 1920, and won a pivotal victory in the revolution. To honor their liberator, a jubilant citizenry renamed the city Stalingrad, but words alone could not repair the damage wrought by war. The factories had been rendered useless, famine struck down tens of thousands, and Moscow decided the only way to save the area was to return it to its industrial state. It was a wise decision. The new industrial plants soon were exporting tractors, guns, textiles, lumber, and chemicals to all parts of the Soviet Union. During the next 20 years, the city grew by leaps and bounds along the high cliffs of the western bank of the Volga. Now, 500,000 people called it home. When General Yeremenko first looked down on Stalingrad through the window of the plane bringing him to battle, he thrilled at the sight. Hugging the serpentine bends of the Volga, the city looked like a giant caterpillar, 16 miles long and filled with smokestacks belching forth clouds of soot that told of its value to the Soviet war effort. White buildings sparkled in dazzling sunlight. There were orchards, broad boulevards, spacious public parks. During the drive from the airport through the city, Yeremenko felt himself overwhelmed by the power and charm of the raw-boned metropolis. The general's underground command post was located in the city's heart, only 500 yards away from the western shore of the Volga, in the north wall of a 200-foot-deep, dried-up riverbed called Tsaritsa Gorge, a superb location for a headquarters. Some said that it had been built years before on explicit orders from Premier Stalin himself. The bunker had two entrances, one at the bottom of the gorge and the other at the very top, leading into Pushkinskaya Street. Each entrance was protected from bomb blasts by heavy doors, plus a series of staggered reinforced partitions, or baffles. The interior was lavish by Russian military standards. The walls were paneled with an oaken plywood surface. There was even a flush toilet. In his comfortable office, Yeremenko immediately began to familiarize himself with his domain. On the desk lay a huge contour map, marked in pencil to show the demarcation line between his southeast front and the Stalingrad front to the north, commanded by General A.V. Gordov. The boundary ran straight as an arrow from the town of Kalach, 40 miles west at the Don River, to the same Tsaritsa Gorge where Yeremenko sat. The longer he examined the artificial border, the more he fumed at Stavka's inability to realize that the dual-front concept was absurd. Worse, he had already spoken with General Gordov and discovered him to be as insufferable as he was reported to be. In the best of times, a difficult man. Under pressure, Gordov became a tyrant, humiliating his staff, inciting open revolt among subordinates. Now faced with Yeremenko, a rival for power, he was evasive, uncooperative, and unpleasant. But since there was no point waiting for Stavka to admit its mistake and reassign command responsibilities, Yeremenko tried to come to grips with his own immediate assignment. He lingered over the map, searching its symbols for clues to a defensive strategy. Between Kalach and Stalingrad, there was only steppe country, flat, grassy terrain that was perfect for German panzers. He next eliminated the assorted farms in the region, the Kolkhozy, where he knew thousands of Stalingrad's citizens were finishing the job of snatching a bumper wheat harvest from the invaders. The farm crews out there had been straining under the brutal sun, while Stuka dive bombers machine-gunned them and set fire to trains filled with grain. Nevertheless, 27,000 fully loaded freight cars had already rolled away to safety in the east. Behind them came 9,000 tractors, threshers, and combines, along with 2 million head of cattle, bawling plaintively as they pounded toward the Volga and a swim to the safety of the far shore. The harvest victory was the only one that Yeremenko could savor. 4 rings of anti-tank ditches, being dug 20 to 30 miles west of Stalingrad, offered little hope. Neither did the Green Belt, a 29-mile arc of trees planted years before to ward off the effects of dust clouds and snowstorms. Only a mile wide at its thickest point, it could not withstand the concentrated fire of heavy artillery. Yeremenko's attention wandered southward, down the map to the rail center of Katinakova, 73 miles away. Captured by the Germans on August 2nd, the city controlled the main road to Stalingrad. The German line of march was obvious. Through Chileko, where the Siberian 208th Division had just been decimated by the Luftwaffe, and on to the towns of Krugliakov and Abgenerovo. At the latter location, Yeremenko paid closer attention to swirling lines on the contour map, indicating hills rising to elevations of from 200 to 300 feet. The hills followed the main road the rest of the way to the congested suburbs of Stalingrad. With mounting excitement, he noted deep ravines cutting across the region from east to west, and concluded that it would have to be in this 20-mile strip of hill country that he would try to halt the German advance. Deep in his heart, however, Yeremenko knew that eventually he would have to fight for Stalingrad block by block and street by street. So, as he pored over the map, he embarked on a peculiar mental exercise, replacing the map's impersonal symbols with his own images of rock formations, houses, and streets. He strove to understand the battleground he had inherited. The southern part of Stalingrad became a jumble of white wooden homes, surrounded by picket fences and flower gardens. This was Dargova, a residential zone just below some light industrial development that crowded close to the Volga. A sugar plant and a massive concrete grain elevator that looked like a gray dreadnought on a prairie sea. A short distance north of the elevator, the Tsaritsa Gorge cut its 200-foot deep scar in the earth before it ran due west for several miles into the steppe. Just above this dividing line was Gordov's territory, over which Yeremenko had no jurisdiction. But he kept on with his studies, because he intended to be ready when Stavka came to its senses. Here was the heart of the city. It encompassed more than 100 blocks of offices, stores, apartment buildings, and was bounded on the east by the central ferry landing, the only major crossing point on the Volga, plus a promenade along the Volga shore. To the north, it was cut off from the next section of the city by another deep ravine, the Krutoy Gully, and on its western flank was another drab community of single-story frame houses. Yeremenko sensed immediately that this whole central section of the city could become a fearsome line of defense. Reduced to rubble by gunfire, the fallen bricks and mortar would provide perfect cover for Russian infantry. The center of town also contained Railroad Station No. 1. For months, trains had passed through it carrying refugees from other battlegrounds, Leningrad, Odessa, Kharkov. Crammed into cattle cars, when the train stopped in Stalingrad, they jumped off to find water and barter for food with merchants lining the platforms. While they haggled for fruit and bread, the penniless among them stole whatever they could behind the vendors' backs. But in early August, the motley traffic from other fronts had to share train space with thousands of Stalingrad natives who suddenly had been ordered eastward into Asia by official decree. Now the terminal was swollen to the bursting point with tearful relatives embracing children, old men, and women amid choked promises to write and keep well. The shrill whistles of the locomotives finally separated the groups. With a last wave and forced smile, a new flood of refugees joined the trek into the vast interior of Russia. A half block east of the station, the men responsible for the city's evacuation occupied a 5-story office building on the west side of the shrub-lined Red Square. Across the square, beside the cavernous post office, the newspaper Stalingrad Pravda, Truth, still printed a daily edition and distributed it to an anxious readership. Under the guidance of the chairman of the city Soviet, Dmitry M. Pigalev, and other members of the council, it published information about air raid drills, rationing, as well as battle reports from the front. To ward off panic, it reported only that the Red Army was scoring impressive victories west of the Don. Close by, the squat, ugly bulk of the Univermag department store guarded the northeast corner of the square. Once a showroom for fashions from sophisticated Moscow, its counters now held only essential items: underwear, socks, trousers, shirts, coats, and boots. In the Univermag's gloomy basement warehouse, reserve stocks had sunk to an alarmingly low level. At the south side of the square, the Corinthian-columned Gorky Theater still hosted a Philharmonic orchestra that played regularly in an ornate auditorium festooned with graceful crystal chandeliers hovering over 1,000 velvet-backed seats. The theater represented the pinnacle of perfection for Stalingrad citizens who resented the city's reputation as a provincial pretender to culture. North of Red Square, soldiers clucked horse carts along wide boulevards, past row after row of sterile, white brick apartment houses that looked like barracks. Automobile traffic was minimal and exclusively military in nature. In the evenings, the streets would be filled with pedestrians strolling beneath maple and chestnut trees lining the sidewalks. Many strollers whistled tunes from Rosemarie, which had played for 3 weeks at a downtown theater. Occasionally, a public garden separated the housing complexes. On Sovietskaya Street, a bank interrupted the residential pattern. A flour mill intruded along Pensenskaya Street. Closer to the Volga, in a library facing the river, a prim matron handed out copies of books by Jack London, a favorite author of the young people. Neighborhood stores tucked into corner lots competed for business. Auerbach the tailor offered soldiers in ragged uniforms a dingy shop in which quick repairs could be made. Swarms of flies pestered women as they picked over watermelon and tomatoes at open-air markets. Beauty parlors were crowded with girls on off-duty time from war work at the factories. In the Tsaritsa Gorge, Andrei Yeremenko had already scanned the intersection at Solochnaya Street to assess its military significance. He also examined labyrinth side roads off the 9th of January Square. What really fascinated him was that immediately to the north of Krutoy Gully, the buildings abruptly gave way to a grassy, rock-studded slope rising to a height of 336 feet. This was Mamaev Hill, once a Tartar burying ground, and now a picnic area. From there, a casual observer could see most of the city. The view was breathtaking. To the west, there was an uninhabited stretch of steppe country, badly broken by balkas, deep, dried-up riverbeds, and, on the distant horizon, a line of homes and a few church steeples. To the north was the awesome network of industrial plants that had made Stalingrad a symbol of progress within the communist system. Almost at the base of Mamaev were the yellow brick walls of the Lazar chemical plant. They covered most of a city block and were girdled by a rail loop resembling a tennis racket. From the Lazar, trains puffed north past an oil tank farm on the bluff beside the river, then on to the Red October plant, with its maze of foundries and calibration shops, from which poured small arms and metal parts. Further north, the trains passed the chimneys and towering concrete ramparts of the Barakati gun factory, whose outbuildings ran back almost a quarter mile to the Volga bank. There, a row of workers' homes languished in an unfinished state. Around the yards of the Barakati, hundreds of heavy-caliber gun barrels lay stacked, awaiting shipment to artillery units at the front. Beyond the Barakati loomed the pride of Russian industry, the Zherezinsky Tractor Works. Once the assembly point for thousands of farm machines, since the war, it was one of the principal producers of T-34 tanks for the Red Army. Built in 11 months, the tractor factory had opened officially on May 1, 1931, and when it was completed, it ran for more than a mile along the main north-south road. Its internal network of railroad tracks measured almost 10 miles. Many workshops had glass roofs to permit a maximum use of sunlight. Ventilation ducts, cafeterias, and showers had been added to the plant to make the workers' lives more pleasant and productive. On the other side of the main road, paralleling the 11 miles of industrial park, a special, self-contained inner city had sprung up to accommodate families of factory employees. More than 300 dwellings, some six stories high, housed thousands of workers. Clustered around carefully manicured communal parks, they were only a few minutes' walk from summer theaters, the cinema, a circus, soccer fields, their own stores and schools. Few factory personnel living in this compound ever wanted to leave it. The state had provided almost every basic necessity, and the model community that Stalin had fostered was a showpiece of the Soviet system. From his mental perch on Mamaev, Andrei Yeremenko was not unduly concerned about the view north into the economic heart of Stalingrad. Even the most powerful field glasses of an artillery observer, should he chance to be a German, would not be able to penetrate as far as the tractor works, or past it to the uppermost boundary of Stalingrad, the Mokraya Mechetka River. What alarmed Yeremenko about Mamaev was its staggering vista to the east, down the shimmering Volga, which was jammed daily with hundreds of tugs, barges, and steamers, whistling at each other in riverboat language and trailing wreaths of smoke as they navigated the channels between Barren Golodny and Sarpinsky Islands. The route they traveled, a vital artery of the Soviet war machine and necessary to any intended defense of Stalingrad, was completely exposed to the whims of the army that possessed the hill. Furthermore, the far shore, which was as flat as a billiard table and stretched into infinity, lay open to observation. So was its lush meadowland, once an amusement park for vacationers who went there to dance or to swim at the pearl-white beaches and to spend weekends at the cottage village near the shore. Now the meadowland was deserted, but through it, in time of need, must come the soldiers, ammunition, and food for the relief of Stalingrad, and from Mamaev, an enemy could easily track every boat that left it. Finished with his exercise, Yeremenko wearily pushed his map away and began issuing orders. Now, more than before, he was determined to dig in firmly along the line of hills that began near Abgenerovo. Proper anti-tank defenses there should delay the German advance, but first he had to scrape up enough manpower for the job. Above his bunker, a flaming red sun had set. The night air was uncomfortable and muggy. Civilians walked down to the relative cool of the river embankment, where a crowd of evacuees waited for a ferry to arrive from the opposite bank. In a waiting room beside the ferry pier, men and women filled pots of boiling water from giant copper kettles. Some used the water to wash clothing, others to make tea from dried apricots or raspberries. It was all they had left. Chapter 5. The dawn of August 7th engulfed the steppe country with a rush of blazing color and burning heat. In the gullies and hollows just outside the thatched huts of the village of Ostrov, 20 miles west of the Don River, Russian soldiers stretched and rubbed their eyes. Tall, broad-shouldered Major Nikolai Tamskushin faced a special personal dilemma. When, on July 15th, he was ordered to take his artillery regiment onto the steppe to protect 62nd Army headquarters, his superior had told him, "In the event of encirclement, save your men before your equipment." But on July 28th, Tamskushin heard another command, this time from Radio Moscow and Premier Stalin, who told the Red Army to hold at all costs. Not one step back, was the ultimatum Stalin issued. As his men ate breakfast, German planes appeared overhead, and Tamskushin called 62nd Army headquarters for further guidance. The line was dead. "Hello? Hello?" he shouted. No one answered. The major dropped the phone and ran to find someone on the staff who could give him new orders, but he was stunned to find that 62nd Army headquarters had disappeared. His commanders had fled to Stalingrad. Trained for years to obey and serve, he hurried back to his regiment. In the next hours, German tanks blew up most of his 76mm guns. Stuka dive bombers burned the steppe grass around him with incendiary bombs. In desperation, Tamskushin dispatched a messenger to the rear, to the bridge crossing the Don at Kalach, where he hoped there was some sort of headquarters. While he waited for orders, the blinding disk of the sun beat down. The Stukas hovered and dove. Casualties soared. By late afternoon, more than 400 men lay dead or wounded in the grass. The messenger never returned. At twilight, Tamskushin gathered his aides. "Assemble the men after dark," he told them. "Head for the Don. Take everyone and everything that can move." He had made his compromise between conflicting orders. In the sudden cool of nightfall, the men formed up and shuffled off to the east. Conversation was forbidden. Even so, weapons clanked against mess tins, and the troops cursed loudly when they stumbled. As the moon peeped fitfully through the clouds, Tom Skushin listened for suspicious sounds. Occasionally, a rifle popped, but it was always far away, and the major whispered his troops on. Suddenly, the darkness burst into 1,000 lights, and tracer bullets ripped into the column from both sides of the road. "Ambush!" Tom Skushin screamed. "Run! Run to the river!" The regiment stampeded into the darkness, but Tom Skushin stayed behind. It was quiet now, except for moans from the road, and he crawled into the high grass to await the dawn. Lying under a brilliant canopy of stars, he thought of his family, safe in Sverdlovsk behind the Ural Mountains. He had not seen them for more than a year since the war began, and swept him to this wretched field. He thought, too, about his military career, irrevocably ruined since he had chosen to move back against Stalin's orders. While he had no regrets about disobeying a senseless order that conflicted with his duty to his men, he had no illusions about the fate awaiting him back at headquarters. His offense was punishable by death. As dawn streaked the sky, the major rummaged in a pocket for his wallet and took out wrinkled pictures of his wife and son, 6-year-old Vladimir. He held the photos a long time before he put them down and reached for his pistol. As he raised the gun and fingered the trigger, the image of Vladimir seemed to rise up before him. He hesitated, wanting desperately to hold the boy in his arms. Even imprisonment in Germany might be better than destroying his last chance to see the child. He eased the pistol back in the holster. The Germans found him in the high grass. "Ruki Verk!" they shouted. He raised his hands meekly in surrender. They took his wallet and ring, but they did not abuse him, and he rode away from the battlefield on top of a German tank. Tom Skushin was not afraid. In fact, he felt invigorated. He had a dream to realize someday, back behind the Urals, where little Vladimir watched for his return. In the aftermath of the battle around Ostrov, the German Sixth Army counted its booty. More than 57,000 prisoners, more than 1,000 tanks destroyed. As a result, General Paulus saluted his men with a special message. "The Russian 62nd Army and great parts of the 1st Tank Army are destroyed. Thanks to a brave advance, the possibility of this victory was set. We proudly think of the fallen on the next task set by the Führer." Despite the fantastic success of Paulus's forces in crushing the last Russian resistance west of the Don, the most immediate danger to Stalingrad was the 4th Panzer Army, which was swinging northeast to join the assault on the city. Any advance they made would be along a major highway and rail line, and they had no rivers to cross. It was logical, then, that the commander of the 4th Panzer Army, horse-faced Papa Hot, should relish his new assignment. His scouts had already worked their way to within 20 miles of Stalingrad's outskirts, and with luck, Hot hoped to beat Paulus into the city. Even the latest intelligence reports of stiffening Soviet resistance at the low range of hills crossing the railroad and highway near Abgenerovo, just south of the city, did not worry him. He was confident he could not be stopped. Most of the Russian stragglers retreating towards Stalingrad would have agreed with this estimate of the situation. Disillusioned, desperate, they had been reduced to fighting each other for scraps of food and water, especially water, which was scarce on the barren steppe. At precious watering holes, they found another enemy had been there before them. The Kalmucks, natives to the region and intensely anti-communist, had thrown dead animals into the wells. The poisoned water quickly killed unwary drinkers. One retreating Russian soldier, curly-haired Lieutenant Hirsch Gurewitz, forgot his thirst as he dove into a ditch for the third time that day. The Stukas were back, like prehistoric birds, circling impudently, searching for carrion below. Gurewitz was exhausted. Chased by the Germans for more than a year, he had begun to wonder where it would all end. Just 21 years old, a native of Mogilev near the Polish border, he had first joined the Red Army in 1940 during the war with the Finns. Then, his mother had been a Communist Party member, working for the military. His father taught violin at the Rimsky-Korsakov School of Music in Mogilev. The German invasion had brought death to both his mother and sister, who were tracked down and slain as partisans. His father and brother disappeared into the army, and Hirsch had been unable to locate them since. Now in the ditch 50 miles southwest of Stalingrad, Gurewitz was a hardened veteran. He could tell by the sound of a shell whether it was close or meant for someone behind him. He knew the exact moment to run for cover when bombers began to hurtle down out of the sun. He knew other things, too, like the price of desertion. He had seen the green hats of the NKVD instilling their special brand of discipline. The NKVD first appeared on the battlefield in July, when Joseph Stalin made the Red Army a scapegoat to appease public indignation and fear about the German advance across the steppe. Stalin's Order No. 227 had unleashed a reign of terror. At countless roadblocks, the Green Hats inspected papers, asked curt questions, and shot anyone suspected of running from the front. Thousands of corpses lined the roads as a warning to those contemplating such desertion. Gurewitz had seen mounds of bodies at the checkpoints, but they did not shock him, for he had seen worse. The previous winter, fighting as a partisan, he had entered the town of Rudnia just after the Germans left. The body of a woman lay in the street. She was blonde, young, and must have been pretty, but her arms, extended upward, had no hands, and her legs had been cut off above the knees. Someone had slit her torso from navel to crotch with a knife or bayonet. Around the corpse stood a crowd of people crying loudly. One man spoke up in trembling indignation. "This was our school teacher," he said, weeping. "She taught our children." His stomach churning, Gurewitz had turned away. Once, when the Germans caught him, he had learned of their savagery firsthand. Trapped in an ambush, he was marched for miles with a rope around his neck as an object lesson to villagers. A sign pinned to his chest read, "I am a Russian partisan." Later, at Gestapo headquarters, he passed into the hands of specialists, two blonde officers in black uniforms, who pulled him into a room where another partisan had been strapped onto a table. While Gurewitz watched, a German turned a lever, and the table moved apart in sections like a rack. A terrible scream burst from the man's throat, and his leg bones snapped through his skin. The lever turned again, and his arms ripped apart in jagged tears. When the man fainted, his torturers shot him dead. Gurewitz then went to his own chamber of horrors, where he was pushed into a chair and his head was forced back. An interrogator hovered over his face and slowly threaded a thin wire up his nose. While Gurewitz tried to retch, the wire entered his lung, jerked horribly, and he fell unconscious. He awoke lying in the snow, his hands tied to a horse's tail. He dimly heard someone shouting, then a slap, and the horse reared and galloped off at full speed. Snow flew in his face. He gasped for breath. The horse bucked through drifts and smashed Gurewitz into the ground again and again. His head cracked against something solid. He felt a searing pain, then nothing. Incredibly, he regained consciousness between the crisp sheets of a hospital bed in Moscow. He was alive only because his partisan comrades had followed him to Gestapo headquarters and ambushed his tormentors. Yet, every night in the weeks that followed, Gurewitz dreamed of wires and broken bones and a schoolteacher with severed limbs. The nightmares always left him spent and fearful, but through it all, he never broke and cried. Returning to duty, he became an officer in the Red Army and went to an advanced infantry training school at Krasnodar in the Caucasus, at that time far behind the front lines. But the summer of 1942 quickly brought German tanks to the edge of the city and forced Gurewitz and his fellow students into an authorized retreat to the Volga. Now on the dusty road to Siti, he cringed as the Stukas nosed over into their dives. The concussions from explosions swept over him and pounded the breath from his body. One blast caught a cadet out in the open and ignited Molotov cocktails that were strapped to his back. A human torch, the soldier danced convulsively, his back exploding in brief orange puffs as the gasoline fed on his body. Ignoring the planes, Gurewitz ran from the ditch to help. Kneeling over the charred, sizzling body, he saw a monstrous sight. The man's chest had burned away, exposing the entire rib cage and his furiously pumping heart. The man he once had known was no longer recognizable, his face had melted. Gurewitz stared in horror. Another bomb exploded nearby, and there was a sharp pain in his back, but he remained kneeling beside the blackened lump in the road until the heart contracted one last time and stopped. Only then did he leave what remained of his friend. Bleeding heavily from his own shrapnel wounds, he went on to Citi for first aid, and then rode an ambulance through Stalingrad to a recuperation center across the Volga. As his back healed slowly, he began to badger doctors about releasing him to active duty. They told him to be patient. The summons would come soon enough. To save his southern flank, Yeremenko ordered his retreating soldiers to hold at Obgenerovo, while he reinforced them with whatever fresh troops he could find. The last anti-tank guns that he could locate on August 9th were ordered to dig into the hills overlooking the highway and the railroad. 59 tanks were sent on a suicidal attack. It was not much of a holding action, Yeremenko knew, but it might at least buy a day's time. Meanwhile, along his Don River flank to the west of Stalingrad, the bridge at Kalach was the key to the situation. Thus, Colonel Pyotr Ilyin received orders directly from Yeremenko to hold or destroy the bridge. The men of Ilyin's 20th Motorized Brigade were hollow-eyed with fatigue. Running low on both guns and ammunition, they dug in at an orchard on the outskirts of Kalach and listened quietly as Ilyin explained that they were to be a rear guard. Ilyin tried to assure them that other Russian divisions would protect their flanks, that with this added support, they could hold their position on the river. Few men in the brigade believed him, and he was thankful that none of them deserted that first night. Across the Don, all was silent. From their positions on the low, flat east bank, Russian soldiers could not see past the lip of the 300-foot bluff across the river that was controlled by the Germans. Ilyin sent scouts across the river, where they trained binoculars on enemy troop concentrations, and for several days, an uneasy quiet descended on that part of the steppe. Ilyin took advantage of the situation to carefully dig in his few artillery pieces and the last of his machine guns at strategic points. Then he waited. On the morning of August 15th, the scouts tumbled back down the palisades on the far shore and screamed, "They're coming!" Behind them, German soldiers suddenly lined the cliff. On Ilyin's orders, sappers blew the explosive charges they had placed under the bridge. It heaved into the air with a shattering roar. When the smoke cleared, the western section had fallen into the river and the eastern part was on fire. Ilyin had gained some time. Behind the protection of the high bluffs on the opposite shore, the Germans plotted new tactics, and 28-year-old Captain Gerhard Münch made the rounds among his men. Recently made a battalion commander in the 71st Division, an extraordinary promotion for one so young. Münch wanted to make sure his troops understood that he cared about them. He listened patiently as they griped about the heat, the food, and the lack of mail. Finally, satisfied that they appreciated his interest, he went to an observation post at the edge of the Don cliff. Below lay Kalach, a cluster of old houses with an apple orchard on the outskirts. Beyond it, in the hazy distance, Münch could see almost to Stalingrad. In the apple orchard across the river, Colonel Ilyin had just learned that the other Russian divisions protecting his flanks had melted away, and he was left alone to hold the German Sixth Army at bay. To complicate matters, Ilyin was unable to raise anyone in Stalingrad headquarters by radio for instructions. As if sensing his dilemma, the Germans came for him right away. At point-blank range, Ilyin's gunners blew apart their fleet of rubber boats. But more than 25 miles upstream, 6th Army engineers under Major Josef Linden, a bookish-looking technician from Wiesbaden, had thrown two pontoon bridges across the Don. Faced only by scattered resistance, the engineers quickly secured a bridgehead on the eastern shore, and Paulus ordered three divisions toward the 300-foot spans. Hundreds of tanks plowed up the roads and fields on their way to the river. They stopped on the western side of the Don while the cautious Paulus tidied up his lines, refitted his armor, demanded more quartermaster supplies, and coordinated more Luftwaffe bomber support from improvised steppe airfields. Filling their mess tins at field kitchens, German troops now spoke openly about furloughs back in Germany and civilian jobs awaiting them after a final thrust to the Volga. Their mood was jubilant, their expectations heady. On the evening of August 22nd, two men stood in a garden near the German bridgehead and talked urgently of the next day's work. One of them was General Hans Huber of the 16th Panzer Division. A courier handed him a dispatch. Huber read it quickly and said, "The balloon goes up at 0430 hours tomorrow, Sikkenius." Colonel Sikkenius acknowledged the news, and Huber dismissed him. "Till tomorrow, Sikkenius." "Till tomorrow, Herr General." Huber paused, touched his only hand to his cap, and remarked, "Tomorrow night in Stalingrad." 40 miles to the east, signs had been posted on trees throughout Stalingrad exhorting the citizens. "Death to the invader," they read. But few civilians knew exactly where the enemy was. In the Tsaritsa Gorge, Andrei Yeremenko agonized over the obvious buildup going on in Paulus's sector. Intelligence showed that the Germans were planning another classic pincer movement with 6th Army acting as the left arm and Hoth's 4th Panzers as the right. And though he had been able to stall Hoth temporarily in the hills around Obgenerovo, Yeremenko knew he had too few reserves available to cope with such a combined attack. On the political front, at least, he had scored an impressive victory. A newfound friend, Commissar Nikita Sergeyevich Khrushchev, had proven a reliable ally in recent days, as Yeremenko argued about the dual command problem with Stavka on the Bodo Line, the direct telephone link to the Kremlin. Khrushchev was Stalin's political emissary to the military council in the Tsaritsa command post, and he had backed Yeremenko fully in his campaign to realign divisions of authority. Finally, on August 13th, Stalin had given Yeremenko supreme responsibility for both fronts and demoted the irascible General Gordov. Now, in complete charge of Stalingrad's defense, Yeremenko had to cope immediately with another unexpected problem. The city's garrison commander had disappeared, leaving chaos behind. Without a local leader, the city's forces floundered. Their confused state was most noticeable in the streets. Military vehicles were getting lost, and accidents proliferated at intersections as drivers jockeyed for the right of way and drove far faster than regulations allowed. Since discipline was broken, hundreds of Russian garrison troops were beginning to desert to the far side of the Volga. With all his problems out on the steppe, General Yeremenko struggled to restore order within his own house. The thunder of tank motors shattered the early morning darkness of August 23rd, and from the steppe, lines of German panzers moved awkwardly to the bridges that crossed the Don. They maneuvered carefully onto the pontoon tracks and gingerly picked their way to the far side. Trucks followed, carrying infantry, ammunition, food, medicine, and fuel. The movement attracted the attention of the Russians, who fired artillery in the general direction of the noise, but their aim was erratic, and the panzers and support troops quickly assembled into 3 fan-shaped combat groups on the eastern side of the river. At a signal, they roared across the steppe beneath a stunning, sudden dawn. The sky was gray, then brilliantly orange and red and violet, and finally a yellow gleam that seared the tankers' eyes and made them marvel at the beauty of the Russian prairie. Lieutenant Hans Odel was ecstatic as he saw the sky turn into an azure blue, untrammeled by clouds. For Odel, a 22-year-old former city employee in Munich, the Sunday morning was absolutely perfect. Even the enemy was cooperating. Only sporadic gunfire intruded from the flanks as the tank column headed toward the Volga. He watched in fascination as Stukas dove on unseen positions to silence the opposition. When the planes returned, the lieutenant waved gaily at them, and they responded by sounding their sirens in acknowledgement. Marveling at the technical cooperation within his army, Odel patted his pet goat in satisfaction. He had found Maidi wandering alone on the steppe, put a red ribbon around her neck, and kept her ever since as an affectionate friend. Now Maidi stood beside her master while his tank column whirled by through dense clouds of dust. Wheels and treads loosed billowing clouds of grime. Most men tied handkerchiefs over their mouths and wore goggles. At the tip of the spearhead, radio operators of the 16th Panzer Division kept 6th Army headquarters informed of each kilometer they clicked off. At Golubinka, 6th Army's new command center on the west bank of the Don, General Paulus read a dispatch. 9:45 a.m. Russians seem surprised about attack and not too strong between Rososhka and Don. In north, we count on heavy resistance. But resistance in the north, on the tank group's left flank, was almost non-existent. The panzers pushed ahead easily, and Hans Odell continued to relish the beauty around him. It was the most beautiful day he had seen during the war. Noon passed, and the panzers kept driving eastward into the haze. The sun turned from its zenith and dropped behind tank commanders standing in their turrets. Their faces were caked with dirt, but they were happy. Within a short time, they expected to see the Volga. Some officers reminded themselves that the river was more than 1,000 miles from Germany. Behind the 16th Panzers, the 3rd Motorized Division tried desperately to keep pace, but slowly fell behind as the dust clouds blinded the drivers. Further to the rear, the 60th Motorized Division was in a hopeless snarl, with horns honking and tempers flaring. A man stepped from the side of the road and faced a column of trucks. Pointing a pistol directly at the first vehicle, he yelled, "If you don't let us through, you'll get it right in the tires." The astonished soldier pulled over to give Dr. Otmar Kohler the right of way. Kohler, a brilliant acerbic surgeon, had served with the division since its formation in Danzig in 1939. He was fed up with delays. He believed his place was up front with the wounded. For months, he had been promoting a plan whereby doctors could treat seriously wounded men within minutes of their being hit, instead of sending them far to the rear for aid. In so doing, Kohler had gone against Wehrmacht traditions, but he was convinced he was right. That attitude was indicative of his personality, which now brought him to the middle of the road with a drawn gun. Impatient with incompetence, he acted without hesitation to correct the situation. Kohler waited until his unit re-entered the line, then jumped into a motorcycle sidecar and waved his driver on. Blinded by the sun, the man drove straight into a hole. Kohler smashed his head against the driver's helmet, felt something in his face pop, and cringed in agony. Feeling his mouth, he diagnosed the ailment immediately: a broken upper jaw. Nauseated from the pain, he swigged down some cognac and ordered the driver to catch up with the rest of the medical detachment. At Golubinka, a clerk made a notation in the war diary of the 6th Army. 1 p.m. still further confirmed the enemy was surprised. The advance continued into the afternoon. Tank commanders tensed when they saw church steeples and white houses on the horizon. Clutching their throat microphones, they told their crews, "On the right is Stalingrad." The men clambered up for a look at a montage of homes, balkas, and smokestacks that passed beside them, and cheers echoed along the column. Then shells erupted around the lead tanks, and they buttoned up for a fight. The Stukas came back, and tanks fired point blank into gun emplacements. Tankers who dismounted and stood over the blasted holes saw bits of calico and cotton dresses, arms and legs, and female torsos tossed carelessly about. They went back to their vehicles and told everyone that the Russians had sent women to fight them. The march to the Volga continued. Some of the tankers were sick to their stomachs. The sun was low in the west when the first German tank came to a halt at the edge of a sheer cliff overlooking the Volga. Lieutenant Gottfried Adamite, the son of a minister, stared in awe across the river. He could see almost 100 miles into the mysterious flat land on the other side. As he put it, he was looking into the heartland of Asia. When Hans Odell arrived, he hopped down from his vehicle and joined the rush to bathe in the river while his goat, Maidi, feasted on the lush vegetables in the fields. German soldiers, officers, and men stripped and plunged into the cold water. Afterwards, recalling the scene, Odell wondered openly why it had to be that war was the only way he could see such a magnificent natural wonder. Behind the main column, late-arriving soldiers entered the suburbs of Rinok, just north of Stalingrad, and followed tram cars down the trolley tracks. When passengers looked back and saw troops dressed in strange uniforms, they panicked and jumped off the trains. The Germans laughed and left the Russians alone for the time being. By 6 o'clock p.m., the German 6th Army held a small stretch of the Volga north of Stalingrad. Hundreds of trucks and tanks moved up in support, while radio operators of the 16th Panzer Division transmitted the news back to headquarters. It had been another fantastic day for General Paulus. Chapter 6. Most of Stalingrad had been asleep when the Germans crossed the Don. In the tractor works, men and women from the night crew were preparing 60 tanks for final assembly when, at 5 a.m., someone rushed in with news of the enemy breakthrough. Amid a babble of noise, supervisors called a meeting to organize defense lines around the factory. To the south, deep inside the Tsaritsa Gorge, Andrei Yeremenko woke up to a barrage of frantic telephone calls from threatened outposts along the German line of march. Surprised at the audacity of the narrow thrust toward the Volga, the general quickly routed sleepy staff officers from beds all over town and ordered breakfast for himself from the bunker's kitchen. Only 500 yards away, at Red Square, black loudspeaker boxes crackled to life and advised citizens of the possibility of air raids. Few people paid any attention to the message, since the only German air activity in recent days had been made by reconnaissance planes. The city Soviet chairman, Pigalev, broadcast the warning, but did not mention the German tanks now heading for the northern part of the city. He feared the news would sow panic among the population. Mrs. Vlasa Kliagina did not hear the loudspeakers because she had left home early to drop her infant son, Vovo, at a communal nursery. Then she and her daughter, Nadia, joined a neighborhood volunteer group at the southern suburb of Yelshanka, where at 7:30 a.m., with the temperature climbing into the high 90s, she continued to work on a primitive line of anti-tank trenches. Mrs. Kliagina had no idea that General Paulus was about to burst into the city from a completely different direction. Less than 2 miles from Yelshanka, in the suburb of Dargova, an assistant station master, Konstantin Viskov, collapsed into bed. He had just finished a grueling 12-hour tour of duty, shuttling troops, refugees, and supplies through Railroad Station No. 1. As Viskov fell into a deep sleep, his wife tiptoed about doing housework. By 9:30 a.m., activity in the Tsaritsa Gorge accelerated as hundreds of soldiers passed in and out of the underground bunker's two entrances. Plagued by phone calls, Yeremenko had not yet touched the breakfast on his desk. He was speaking now to the deputy commander of the 8th Air Force, who relayed shocking news. "The fighter pilots flying reconnaissance have just returned. They said that a heavy battle is going on in the region of Malaya Rosochka, 25 miles northwest of Stalingrad. Everything is burning on the ground. They saw two columns of approximately 100 tanks each, and after them, compact columns of trucks and infantry. They're all moving into Stalingrad."